He was a morbidly obese surgeon destined for an operating table and an early death. Now he's a rebel MD who is fabulously fit and fighting to make America healthy again. This is Stay Off My Operating Table with Dr. Philip Ovadia.
All right, we're live. This is the Stay Off My Operating Table podcast. The chances are very good that you already knew that because you're listening. But our host is Dr. Philip Ovadia. I'm Jack Heald, and today we've got a guest who is married to a guest we've had before. Phil, why don't you tell us more about this?
Very good, Jack. Great to be here with you. Doing a bit of a location shoot today, as anyone watching on YouTube will pick up on. Very excited to have this conversation with Craig. Like you said, this is going to complete our first husband and wife guest team here on the podcast. But Craig Emmerich is a prolific author, lost count of the number of books that he and his wife have co-authored together, has a great background in biochemistry and science, and looking forward to maybe geeking out a little bit on some of the deep scientific stuff that we don't necessarily get into on a regular basis on the show here. So with that, Craig, why don't you introduce yourself to our audience and tell us a little bit about how you got involved in nutrition, how you got interested in nutrition.
Well, thanks a lot, guys, for having me on. I appreciate it. You know, my background, I was originally an electrical engineer, and it's kind of weird. This nutrition space has a fair amount of engineers in it. There's, you know, like Dave Feldman and, you know, Marty Kendall, and there's quite a few guys. You know, Ted Neiman, he used to be an engineer and is prior to being a doctor, you know, and I think we look at things a little differently, kind of a systems approach, you know, look at the whole system versus little inputs and things. And I think that has helped me as I transitioned to this space. And I did that, I don't know, 15 years ago. And it was all led by my wife, Maria. She was going down this path to heal herself. She had all these health issues. And she found that through her research and reading that she was trying things, and this low carb approach helped her. It reversed her PCOS and her acid reflux, and helped her lose weight, which, you know, she was the extra weight that she was trying to lose at that time. She was doing all the traditional, you know, low fat, healthy whole grains and running marathons, and just, you know, still had all these health issues and everything. And as she did this to herself with her own diet, all that stuff went away, and the extra weight went away, even though she stopped running marathons. And so myself took a little longer to come around on the diet side. You know, I have a strong German background and brewed my own beer, and it was hard to move away from some of that kind of stuff. But about 5 or 6 years after her, which was about 17 years ago now, I fully came on board with the diet. So she's been eating this way for over 20 years. I've been eating this way for like 17, and we've never looked back. And I've tried to dive into the science of it too, the past, you know, 12 to almost 15 years, really, since I've come over to help out on this side of the business.
Well, I want to get into the geeky, nerdy stuff that you alluded to before we started recording. But before we do that, I want to throw a bone to those who like the relationship stuff as well. Is there a story behind how you finally got on board with Maria? Surely, yeah, there's a story.
It, you know, we see this all the time with couples too. Like, you know, most of the time it's the wife that comes, and she's looking for initially weight loss. But, you know, one of the things we found over the 20 years of helping people with this kind of lifestyle is they come for weight loss, but they stay for the health improvements. You know, the weight loss is like just a bonus to how good they feel, to, you know, the medications they got off of, to, you know, symptoms going down or away for different diseases and things. And so that's why they stick around. And what I think what happens is, you know, the husband tends to see all the health improvements and how much energy she has all day long and, you know, all these things. And they're like, well, maybe I should try that. And that's kind of how it happened for me, in that, you know, she would make my lunches for work. And during the week, I just ate whatever she made for me. And then the weekend came and I'd kind of eat whatever I wanted. We went out to restaurants or whatever. And I just started to notice how crappy I felt on the weekends, you know, and how good I felt during the week. And I had that mental clarity, you know, all week. And I wanted that all the time. And so that's when I switched to eating this way full time.
That seems reasonable.
Yeah. And you know, just to follow up on the relationship aspect of it. And as Jack said, I'm excited to get into the geeky nutritional stuff as well. But talk a little bit about building a business with your wife, and you two very much have been partners in this. You know, perhaps Maria, most people might recognize more as the face of it, but yeah. For anyone who really, you know, has been sort of following what you two have been doing, you know, all the books that you've written together, and you know, you're certainly very much involved in everything that's been built.
Yeah, it's been definitely a partnership. You know, it started out, you know, early on, when I was still an engineer, I was helping out her business in the back, you know, in the background. I was, you know, as a technical guy, so I was keeping her website going and, you know, doing any help with the website or any that kind of stuff we needed. So I would just be helping from the back. But as we transitioned over and I came to help full time because it made sense, we you know, the people we were seeing and more people that we had coming to us, we wanted to dedicate more time to it. And the books that we were publishing, you know, I was doing the back end stuff on the books too, like helping with layout and editing. But then as I dove into the science and got a stronger and stronger understanding of that, it made sense for me to start contributing. You know, to the, and all of our latest books, you go back to our book, Keto, The Complete Guide, which was our first like joint collaboration where I actually wrote about half of that book. So all the science and a lot of the first few chapters I wrote, to, you know, the more recent books, all of the front matter I've been doing. So, you know, our carnivore cookbook and our kids book, I do pretty much all the front matter, which is all kind of sciencey type of stuff. And then after that, we have our recipes, and Maria's the recipe queen. And she is a wizard and a chemist in the kitchen of figuring out ways to make different combinations healthy. And so it makes a really, really good partnership in that way, in that we work so good together. But I'll just tell you a little quick story that the type of relationship that we have. She, growing up, she would get annoyed if you will. She was very much, she liked to be alone. She would go camping by herself. And you know, when she would date people, it wouldn't last too long. She would like, kind of done with this person, get annoyed by their whatever.
By their presence.
Well, and she was just, you know, she liked to be on her own. And we went on a hiking trip in Colorado where we were going to hike the Colorado Trail. Like, I don't know how many, 200 and some miles. We were, you know, out there with our backpacks and that's it. And her mom said, if you come back from this and you still like him, you're going to get married. And we did. So, you know, rest is history.
That's good. Okay. I have a confession. I think all of your books.
Oh,
and, I got them because I wanted the recipes. I love the science, don't get me wrong, but I wanted recipes because when we talked to Maria, she talked about this and that and the other thing. And I was like, oh my God, I have got to know how to make these. Yeah. So I had a mild bit of annoyance, and I don't remember which book it was, but I got into one of the books and I was mildly annoyed because I had to wade through so many words before I got to the recipes. I'm totally going to go back and read it. But let's talk about the sciencey nerdy stuff now. Before we started recording, you mentioned that you love to talk about the metabolism of the body, about the energy and what happens and all that kind of stuff. Phil, this is where I depend on you to ask the smart questions. And I'm once again going to represent the average dummy in the audience, or maybe the below average dummy.
Sure thing. Let's get into it. And let's maybe start with, you know, I've had you mentioned at the beginning about, you know, the engineers that have sort of gotten into the nutritional space. And we've had Dave Feldman on, and I've certainly had conversations with some of the others that you've mentioned. And it has intrigued me as well, the difference between how the engineers look at things and the physicians and the clinicians, kind of come at this. So maybe let's go back to sort of, you know, as you were getting into it and Maria had started these dietary changes and, you know, you noticed the results and started thinking about doing it. But how did your engineer mind, you know, come at this? And what were some of the early, I guess, you know, maybe tips or early clues looking at this from an engineer that she was on the right path and that this made sense from a biochemical standpoint?
Yeah, you know, I think engineers, you know, when I think about problem solving, I think about a lot of it is, you know, I'm an electrical engineer. So I think of a chip and I think of inputs and outputs, right? That's what you got. You got inputs going in, you got outputs coming out, right? And depending if my chip is working right, if I give it the right inputs, it should give me the right outputs, right? And I think of the human body a lot the same. You know, if you give the body the right inputs, it's going to generally do the right things with it and give you the right outputs. And the, you know, in our keto, the complete guide, I drew this disease tree, right? Where it's like the roots of this tree are the inputs, your nutrition, getting, you know, common sense sun exposure, you know, to get vitamin D levels, doing things like not smoking, but, you know, exercising. So that's like a negative input and a positive input, you know, all these different things that you can do as inputs then lead to the outputs. What are the outputs? If the inputs are wrong, there's autoimmune disorders, there's cancer, there's Alzheimer's, there's diabetes, you know, all of these type of problems, right? And so I look at it kind of in that way, in that if you change the inputs and the outputs are now correct and they're doing right, your new input was the right input, right? Like you're giving it the right thing and the machine is doing what it's supposed to do, and that the outputs will fix themselves.
Yeah. You know, what's so interesting is that the way that physicians are trained is largely to look at the processes, you know, what's going on the chip. And if the output's wrong, there must be something wrong on the chip. And we really don't go back to look at the input step of it. And, how can we change the chip?
Well, in a lot of healthcare today, they look at it as genetic. Those are just the cards you dealt. And that's what Maria was told. I mean, Maria's kind of origin story, if you will, was, you know, she had all these health issues, PCOS, acid reflux, extra weight she was carrying. She goes into the doctor and the doctor that she went to said, those are the cards you're dealt. There's nothing you can do about it. Here's like three prescriptions to deal with the symptoms. And that same week she goes, our dog was losing patches of its hair. We go to the vet. And the first question is, what are you feeding it? And it's like the doctor, never asked me that once. And yet that's a very important input, right? That could affect these outputs. And so I think that was kind of the connection that was made there.
Okay. Let's get nerdy now.
Yeah.
You talked about sunshine. You talked about vitamin D. And obviously, we're going to end up talking about fat, protein, and carbs. But let's start with the sunshine and the vitamin D. And let's get nerdy.
Well, that's an important one. I mean, you know, we've been all taught and told that, you know, you got to slather on the, you know, SPF 50 the second you get outside and, you know, all of those kind of things. But if you look at the data, I mean, skin cancer has just has climbed steadily forever. And you look at the point when sunscreens came out and now everybody uses them and it just keeps climbing. So if it was that was the solution, you'd see some output change, right? Like you'd see the cancer rates go down, but we don't see it. And one of the common areas in, I saw a study in Japan, one of the common areas for skin cancer was the bottom of the foot. I don't think that gets a lot of sun, you know. But the other issue too with it is, you know, there what populates the skin is a lot of fat, right? In the skin, you've got quite a bit of fat that's in the skin. And that fat, if it's saturated fat and it's very stable fat, it's not going to get oxidized as easily. If it's an omega-6 fat, which is very easily oxidized, and so you're eating a lot of vegetable and seed oils, and that's the kind of fat you got populating your skin, guess what? That's easily oxidized, especially by the sunlight. Like, so that is potentially, to me, I believe that's the bigger problem, is that when you get those vegetable and seed oils, the omega-6s getting populating too much of the skin, and now they're getting oxidized in the sun, causing the problems. I mean, think about it from an ancestral standpoint. Were our ancestors dropping dead like crazy of skin cancer, you know, 50,000 years ago when they were in the sun all day long? No. I mean, this is, you look at the rates, it's a more recent phenomena that's increasing and increasing. So it's something else. And I think it's back to food again.
Yeah.
Just anecdotally, I noticed that two things. One, when I started eating more consciously, or more accurately, consciously avoiding processed foods, and also consciously spending a lot more time in the sun, without sunscreen, I might add, hardly a scientific study, but I felt like I was far less prone to burn.
Yeah, that's
great. Look at me. I'm a white guy. You know, it's, but I, by and large, I don't wear sunscreen at all anymore. I live in the desert. You know, I spend a lot of time out in a really harsh sun. So, with an N of one, I would say eliminating the processed foods has made me much happier in the sunshine.
Well, we have N of many of that example with clients over the last 20 years. People comment all the time that I don't seem to burn, or I don't seem to burn very easily. And I think that's, again, it's back to that root cause, which I believe was the excess of omega-6 fats in the diet.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things that we see in the scientific literature is when you look at older studies, you know, pre-widespread introduction of seed oils, you actually demonstrate that outdoor workers had lower incidence of skin cancer than indoor workers. And, you know, it's only the more recent studies that have, you know, again, in an environment that's primarily omega-6s and lots of vegetables and seed oils, that you then start to see that increasing incidence of skin cancer among the outdoor workers.
That's very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, from an evolutionary standpoint, again, it makes sense. You know, we evolved in the sun. It doesn't really make sense that the sun per se would be damaging, because our evolution wouldn't have allowed that to happen.
Exactly.
Yeah. Very interesting. So, you know, one of the unique nutritional aspects that I think you've spoken a lot about is protein. And specifically, I'd like to get into protein sparing modified fast, which is something, you know, you have at least one book on, maybe multiple books on. And it's something that maybe some people in our audience aren't familiar with. So maybe just start with, you know, what is protein sparing modified fasting, and what unique advantages do you think it might have over other forms of fasting?
Yeah, it's a protein sparing modified fast. It's more of the clinical term. We we used to call it pure protein days, which kind of makes more sense, you know. But what it is they found, this goes back, you know, decades, they were doing fasting studies where people ate nothing, right? They just drank water for, you know, days, weeks. And they found that, you know, obviously they lost weight, and it worked well for weight loss, but they also lost muscle, lean mass. And so they created a protein sparing where it spares your body's protein, modified fast. It modifies a fast to spare your body's protein. And basically all it is essentially zero carbs, just enough protein for your lean mass. So you can calculate how much you need based on how much muscle you have, how big you are, and then maybe 30 grams of fat. And that's it for the fat. So it's not zero fat, and you're still getting some fat to absorb fat soluble vitamins and make, you know, healthy hormones and that kind of thing. But it's a minimal amount so that you kind of mimic a fast in that there's not much energy. You know, protein isn't generally used as energy. Carbs and fat are. So you dial the energy way down and you get some of the speeding up of weight loss effects while maintaining your muscle. And so that for us, that's a tool. It's something that we think is better than an extended fast in that, you know, you can get a lot of the benefits without the negative of losing muscle. Because muscle, let's be honest, as we get older, you know, leucine is the amino acid primarily responsible for triggering muscle synthesis, so building muscle. And as you age, the leucine curve, the threshold to start building muscle shifts, and you need even more to start building muscle as you get older. And that's why so many people, as they get older, start to, you know, sarcopenia, and they start to lose muscle. Well, if that's true, and I'm looking at it today, I'm thinking, you know, it's going to be hard for me to maintain muscle in the future, much less build it. So if I can maintain and or build more now, it's kind of like an investment on my future vitality, right? Like I'm investing in my future as I get to be 60, 70, 80 years old to still have the strength and mobility that I want. And so that's kind of how we look at it. Is it's not a diet. It's not a lifestyle. It's a tool. If instead of doing a 3-day fast, do 2 or 3 days of protein sparing modified fast. And it's a tool in that way.
Okay. Point us in the direction. Is that in one of your books? You talk about that?
We have a couple books about that. Yeah. We have a protein sparing modified fast method, which is a paperback book. And then we have, I think, 4 ebooks that are about protein sparing modified fast with recipes.
Okay, very good. We'll track it down.
So, all right, Jack, you might have to dial it back here a little bit, but I'm going to.
Oh, we're nerding out today.
Very good. So, yeah, leucine as a unique amino acid. And as you said, it's one of the key, and maybe I guess you could say the key amino acid for triggering muscle protein synthesis and muscle growth. So, let's talk what's different about leucine than some of the other amino acids. And, you know, leucine becomes one of the challenging points when you're trying to work with people that are, afraid of eating animal protein or avoiding animal protein, because it's hard to get leucine from non-animal sources. So what's unique about leucine, and what are some of the best sources of leucine?
Well, leucine it's almost like a signaling molecule to the body. Like when the body sees, okay, I'm getting enough of this, I'm going to signal, okay, I know I'm going to have amino acids to build now. And so it's almost like a signaling molecule on that one. And in that way, it can also be important, probably more important for your first meal to have enough than consecutive. Because once you hit that and your body's like, okay, today we're building muscle, you know, you can accumulate and keep adding amino acids and maybe not have quite as much complete, but that first meal, if it's real complete, it'll be helpful, you know, throughout the day. That being said, you know, yeah, the amino acid profile of different proteins is going to be very different, and that will result in very different results for building muscle and whatnot. And especially when you start talking about plant proteins, you know, there's like pea protein, I think is, you know, if you look at there's different indexes and scores, like the the PDCAAS, you know, the amino acid profiling scores, where they, I think it's 0.6 for pea protein, where, you know, like whey protein is like one. So it's very complete. You know, beef is like 0.9 or something. So if you empirically think of that, that means you've got to get 40-50%, almost twice as much pea protein to trigger muscle protein synthesis as you would of whey, right? Because it's 0.6 versus one. So that means you need a lot more of that amino acid. So let's say your protein goal is 100 grams. You might have to get 160 grams of, you know, 180 grams of pea protein before you're getting the same completeness of, you know, of amino acids to build the same amount of muscle. And that's real important, especially when you talk about plants. I remember I saw a meme of the perfect starter kit for a vegetarian, and it was like 30 eggs to start your day, because that was the only complete protein, you know, that you could have. But yeah, it's really important to get enough of the complete amino acids to build and maintain muscle. Again, especially when you're aging, you need more of it. So getting a lot is important.
Is leucine entirely exogenous, or do we produce it?
It's exogenous. It's one of the essential amino acids. Yeah.
Oh, is that what essential amino acid means?
Essential.
We don't produce it?
Yeah. Essential fatty acids, essential amino acids. There's no essential carbohydrates.
Yeah.
But never knew that.
Yeah. Essential from a purely, I guess, nutritional or purely clinical standpoint, what essential refers to is that our bodies can't make it, or at least can't make it in enough quantity that we need to get it from food. Yeah. And that gets bastardized a lot, but that's really what it means from a scientific standpoint. So beyond the preservation of muscle mass or lean tissue mass, what else do you think is unique about protein? You know, when we're looking at it from a weight loss standpoint, you know, and just overall health maintenance, you know, why is protein so important to our bodies?
Well, for starters, I would say that, you know, the amino acids are used for so much. Like, it's not just muscle, it's skin, it's hair, it's your fingernails, it's you know, your bone. There's so much of your bones that are, have, you know, protein component to it, and it's important. I saw a study that showed people with osteoporosis, they were taking a calcium supplement, and the ones that ate below the RDA of protein had actually continued to lose bone. The ones that ate at it maintained, and the ones that ate above it on protein actually built more bone. Reversed some of the osteoporosis. So, I mean, protein is very important for so many pieces of it. But from a weight loss perspective, what's really unique about it is the body doesn't want to use protein as a fuel. It really doesn't. It's a very expensive fuel. You need to, what is it? I think like 5 ATP just to turn it into glucose to then burn it as a fuel. So you're using a bunch of energy up to turn it into something that could be used as a fuel, glucose, through gluconeogenesis, and then burn it as a fuel, right? So it's expensive. It's an energy-intensive process, and the body doesn't really want to do it if it doesn't have to. And when does it not have to? When it's got carbs or fat around. And so if it's got one of these other fuels, it's going to use that instead. And so if you cut the carbs out, and now you've got some fat, whether it's on the body or in the diet, it's going to use that as fuel, and it's going to take these amino acids and use it for all the building, repair, the autophagy and cellular turnover and all the things that it does on a daily basis. And it's just going to use the fat for fuel. But the key is the fat on the body or the fat in the diet. If you've got excess fat on the body taps into that. That's what it's there for. It's like, that's your gas tank, right? And so when you dial the fat down a little bit in the diet, now you force your body to burn the fat on your body more, and that results in weight loss. But the third thing about protein is that, you know, all the macronutrients have thermic effect of food. Thermic effect of food is the amount of energy your body has to expend to digest and process each macronutrient, right? Fat, the thermic effect's only like 3%. So only about 3% of the calories consumed of fat are needed to digest and process it and store it. Protein is 30 to 40% thermic effect, depending on the type of, you know, 25 to as much as 35 to 40 for thermic effect. That means about a third of the calories, if you will, of the protein coming in, you need to burn that much energy just to digest and process it. So you're basically upping your basal metabolic rate, your energy, your body's, you're not exercising, you're just digesting, but you're raising the amount of calories your body's going to burn just through the digestive process. And so that gives you a little bit of a benefit too when it comes to weight loss. So that's why I think prioritizing protein is really important for weight loss.
That's why I, you know, 20 years ago, I heard this science story that it's important to eat first thing in the morning because that kicks your metabolism into gear, and waiting until noon or later to begin your eating just means you're slowing down your weight loss. Is it really because, is it rooted in that?
No, I think it's more of what I talked about earlier, is if you get a good amount of protein in that first meal, that means your body's going to be doing muscle protein synthesis, which is an energy intensive process in itself, right? It's burning more calories all day because your body's doing this building and repairing activities with the amino acids. I would say more of your first meal of the day, it's important to have, you know, a good complete protein type of meal, whether that's first thing in the morning or in the afternoon, as long as it's your first meal and it has a good amount of protein in it.
Okay. So that's why protein requires more energy just to digest. Fat requires very, very little. And where do carbs fall in that?
In between, I think it's like 10 to 15% thermic effect. So okay. Less than half of what protein is, pretty much.
Okay. So can we go back to vitamin D?
Sure. I'm not the expert in vitamin D, but.
Oh, well, you teased me there. All right.
Yeah.
Help
well,
me out
you know, sure. You know, I think one of the things we can talk about is, you know, how, so, you know, vitamin D, as many people may be aware of, but probably some aren't, you know, isn't actually a vitamin. It was misnamed when it was, you know, first being discovered, I guess you could say. And it's actually a hormone, and really it's a what we call a pro-hormone. And it's involved it's involved in so many of the different processes that goes on in our bodies, you know, and it's so, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about the importance of sun exposure for our bodies to be able to make vitamin D. And maybe talk about, you know, this might lead into a little bit of a discussion about your thoughts around supplements versus giving your body the proper input. As you said, you know, earlier, you know, when we give our body sun and essentially we aren't poisoning our bodies will make the vitamin D that we need. But oftentimes we've taken the approach in modern times of, I can just take a pill that's called vitamin D, that is vitamin D, and expect that to have the same effects. Like I said, maybe that leads into a little bit about your thoughts around supplementing versus getting these things from food and from our environment.
Yeah, definitely. You know, but the vitamin D supplement's never going to be as good or as effective as what you get in your skin from the sun. And, you know, that's true with pretty much anything when it comes to that, you know, like vitamins and supplements. while they can have a role, especially in disease where you may be deficient and those kind of things, it's always better to get it from your food. You know, it's always better to get it from your whole foods, get the vitamins from those. But, you know, again, in certain situations, that's not necessarily possible. Like there's a study I looked at recently that showed that over the past 50 years, and this was a few, like 15 years ago now, I think this study was, the depletion of the soils had the fruits and vegetables were on average like 30% less vitamins and minerals. And in some cases, some fruits and vegetables, 50% less vitamins and minerals, because we're depleting the soil with the cropping and row cropping and, you know, always depleting the soils of certain nutrients because we're planting the same crops over and over in the same spots. And, you know, so sometimes we can't get what we used to be able to get, right? And it's a great example of that's magnesium. I think like 80% of Americans are deficient in magnesium. And big reason for that is we used to get a fair amount from our water supply, from springs, from natural water sources. Now, what do we drink? We drink filtered, refiltered, bottled, you know, stuff from, you know, the city waters, you know, all processed and filtered. There's nothing left in it. And so we're not getting what we used to. And so in those cases, you know, a supplement is helpful because you're not going to get it from your food or your water supply in sufficient quantities. But, you know, anything, you know, like even like insulin, you know, endogenous insulin that you make in your body is going to be more effective than exogenous that you use externally. It's always, the body's always going to do a better job, you know, when given the right inputs. But, you know, in certain cases like type 1 diabetes, you have no choice. You have to do it. But yeah, that's kind of where I would say lie with that, with respect to that.
So can you take us through the process in the body? I'm talking biology now, energy production. What's happening in the person who's getting plenty of sun versus the one who isn't? How is that affecting us nutritionally and in terms of our overall health?
Well, again, I'm not the vitamin D expert here, but you know, you can look at a lot of different health outcomes. I mean, the most recent example that pops in my head is COVID. You know, there was study after study showing, you know, the relationship of death rates to vitamin D status. And the less vitamin D, the more death rates there were, because it is a powerful hormone that affects our immune system and tons of different bodily functions. So it has a huge role in health for sure.
I have some friends who are nudists, and I've really wished there had been a study of nudists.
Like how often they get colds and things?
Well, in particular, I was looking at COVID, but yeah, just the general overall health compared to a comparable age and sex demographic. So for our proto-scientists out there, there is a really cool sub-demographic that somebody needs to study, actually do a good study. How do nudists react to health threats compared to the general population?
That would be interesting.
Let's pivot a little bit. You know, we talked about protein. Let's talk about fat and, you know, the different types of fats and what effect they have on our metabolism in particular. And I know, you know, you've written a bunch of the books on keto and, you know, in a lot of that front matter, you go into this some. So let's talk a little bit, because I think sometimes, you know, especially when people are first coming to keto or the popularized, you know, keto stuff that's out there today, there isn't enough attention paid to the types of fat. It's just all fat is kind of considered equal, and you want to get, you know, as much fat as possible, essentially, into your keto diet.
Yeah, the way I look at it is the more stable the fat is, the more I'm likely to consume it. And, you know, there's essential fatty acids, and there's omega-3s and omega-6s that are essential fatty acids, and you do need some in the diet. But the problem is today, you know, you go to the store and pick up any bottle of sauce or anything, and it's just a big bottle of vegetable oil. You know, your mayo, your dressings, any of that stuff, it's just a bottle of vegetable oil, usually rapeseed oil, which is, you know, a vegetable oil, all omega-6. And we've been told forever, you want a better omega-6 to omega-3 ratio in your diet. You know, I think typical American, it's like 40 to 1, 40 of omega-6 to 1 of omega-3. And, you know, they talk about getting that to more like 10 to 1 or 21. For me, as long as I'm getting enough essential omega-3s and 6s, which I can get from meat, right? I can get, you know, grass-fed beef is going to have omega-3s. You're going to have, you know, quality eggs will have it. Sources like that, butter, you can get, but then my energy source. So I kind of characterize as, you know, the things that I need essential, get enough of that. Now I have energy, and energy for me is saturated fat. Saturated fat is the cleanest energy source, I think, for the body. And it's when you digest it, it's most like the fat that is stored on your body. And your body's going to store it in the way it wants it, right? It's going to store it in the way it can easily use it as fuel. And I think saturated fat mimics that the closest.
Yeah. And on the, let's maybe get into a little bit of that, you know, how our body handles saturated fats differently from, you know, unsaturated fats, primarily polyunsaturated fats. And specifically, you know, maybe we can get into that sort of mitochondrial energy production from saturated fat versus unsaturated fats.
Well, let's talk about it at a higher level so that everybody can understand just the basic process, right? So you consume a fat, right? And it goes into your digestive tract. And this is an area where I think I will divert a bit from some of the carnivore and keto influencers out there and doctors and whatnot, in that for me, again, I come back to the engineering background of I'm going to mechanistically look at what happens to when I put this input into my body, where does it go and what happens and what does it do? When you eat fat, there's only two places for it to go. You can either get digested and then it ends up in the bloodstream, or it can go right through you, right? So let's look at the go right through you. And that some people will claim that that's where a lot of the fat is going. If there is, you're going to be sitting on the toilet a lot because even an extra 10, 15, 20 grams of fat in the stool is going to be a problem. You know, remember the Wow chips, the Olestra? Remember that? It was a synthetic fat that didn't get digested and went right through you. What did they have to put on the label? It could cause anal leakage because controlled bowels, because an extra, you know, 5-10 grams of fat from those chips going straight through you. And so if you're getting that much fat going into the stool, you're going to have some issues, right? And there's even been studies on this. There's a study that I can provide you the link of that varied the dietary fat from like 60 grams up to 150 grams, I think it was, in dietary fat. And they measured the fecal output in the stool. And it was always like 8 grams of fat in the stool. That was pretty much constant, no matter what.
Regardless of the input.
Of the dietary fat, all the way from like 68 grams up to like 150 grams. I don't know the exact numbers, but it was in that range. And so it's not really going there. Okay. And you don't really want it to because you'd be on the toilet all day. So it gets digested, right? So now it's in the bloodstream, right? So now let's talk about where it can go from there, right? It comes in, it's packaged up into what's called a chylomicron. It's this big, you know, lipid particle that has all this fat in it. And it can either go two places now from there. It can either be burned in the muscle as fuel or be stored in your fat cells, okay? And the majority of it goes and is stored in the fat cells. There's the studies have shown that not a lot of those chylomicrons are distributing energy to the cells. They're mostly dumping into storage. They're kind of on the loop back from the liver and from the bloodstream into storage. And so most of the fat then goes into your fat cells, right? From there, it can come back out and be burned as fuel. But when it comes out, you know, you've got, it's a triglyceride molecule when it's stored in your fat cells. Triglyceride is three free fatty acids connected by a glycerol backbone. Okay. That's a triglyceride. When your body needs some energy and says, send me some fuel. So your insulin goes down, it cleaves off the glycerol, and you got three free fatty acids that go into your bloodstream. And that's what your body is burning for fuel. Most of the energy you burn in your body is free fatty acids directly burned in your muscle and cells. It's not ketones when you're keto. So this is all in the context of, you know, a low carb approach. It's not ketones that you're burning primarily. It's free fatty acids directly. And then some of the free fatty acids can go to the liver and get turned into ketones for the brain, because fatty acids can't cross the blood-brain barrier. So you need ketones for that. And heart muscle and tissues like ketones as well. But glycerol then can go and get turned into some glucose. So you get a little bit of glucose and a bunch of free fatty acids for energy, and that's what fuels your body, and a little bit of ketones for the parts that need it. And so that cycle is kind of, is like to call it fat flux, where you have fat going in and out of these fat cells, right? Diet goes in, then it comes out and gets burned or doesn't. And then if it doesn't, it gets packaged back up into a chylomicron and goes right back into storage. And that's kind of the cycle that's always happening in the body, right? So for me, it's real simple to say, okay, if all the dietary fat I eat, almost all of it, gets packaged up and put into my fat cells, and I'm trying to shrink my fat cells, I'm trying to get skinnier, I'm trying to lose body fat, shouldn't I dial some of the fat in the diet down so that I can burn more off the body and thus lose more body fat? And that's kind of the approach that we've always taken, and I you know, written about in our books, and that's the important thing when it comes to fat, is that you got to understand where the fat is going and what your goal is, so you know how much fat to put in the diet, right? If you're trying to lose weight, dial it down a little bit. If you're trying to maintain, dial it up. And that's the other thing, you know, is a little bit of a pet peeve of mine, but people will look at, you know, influencers, and they'll see what they're eating. Like, for example, Dr. Chaffee, he's huge, he's ripped. I'll never look like him in my life, but you know, people will see what he's eating and they'll think, I'm gonna eat that so I can look like him. Well, no, you're not in maintenance. You don't have that much muscle mass and you're not working out like he does, right? You need to eat a little differently to get there. Once you're there and you look like him, then you can eat like him, right? So something that people have to understand too.
I've often wondered about that. I started, got introduced to essentially a keto way of eating 15, 16, 17 years ago, I guess about the time that you did. And without going into all the research, I often wondered, where is all this fat that I'm consuming going? I've dialed down the carbs. I've seen the weight kind of disappear, but I am eating a lot of fat. Where's it going?
That's your energy, right? And you're fairly lean now. So, you know, you're not trying to, you know, somebody who's 100 pounds overweight, they don't need a lot of fat in the diet. They got a ton of it on the body. And so they can access it much. I like to think of it as, you know, your fat cells. Let's dive into a little other thing that's an important topic.
I'm digging this, by the way. This is the kind of nerdiness I was hoping for.
The primary cause of insulin resistance is overstuffed fat cells. This is something called the personal fat threshold. Okay. So what happens is, when you're a toddler, you make new fat cells. And at a certain point in your life, when you're very young, you stop making new fat cells and you just fill up the fat cells you have and shrink them, right? For the most part. And this shows up in life, right? You get these people that don't seem like they can gain weight no matter what they do, right? Well, they can become type 2 diabetic though. And the reason is that their fat cells, they'd only have so many fat cells, but the ones they have are stuffed and inflamed, because a fat cell, you start stuffing fat in it and it gets to a point where it's like, whoa, I'm going to burst. Stop putting fat in me, reject insulin, and the fat cell becomes insulin resistant because it doesn't want to have any more fat stuffed in it. And if you get too many of these fat cells overstuffed and inflamed, all the fat that's coming in the diet, where's it going to go? The insulin's fasting insulin keeps creeping up because it's trying to drive this fat out of the bloodstream. It does not like all this fat sitting around the bloodstream. And so now it goes wherever it can. It ends up in the liver. You get fatty liver, ends up in the pancreas. You are type 2 diabetic, even though we've had one woman was 105 pounds, but she just did genetically, she had very few fat cells. And so she didn't have anywhere to put it. And she became insulin resistant very quickly. The other end of spectrum, you could have somebody 100 pounds overweight and they're completely metabolically normal, normal A1C, normal insulin, because they have a lot of fat cells and genetically they just have a ton of them. And there's even some rare cases of people that can make new fat cells later in age. And I've actually got a case study on this coming out in a presentation this summer in Tennessee of a man. I don't want to ruin my presentation, but this man is 645 pounds. Good. He has an insulin of 3. He has a fasting blood sugar of like 80 to 90. And he looks completely metabolically normal because his body keeps making new fat cells and he never hits that limit where too many of them are insulin resistant and stuffed. And so he basically will never get insulin resistant. Because he keeps making new fat cells. He's one of those rare genetic cases. But, you know, back to it, that's one of the most important things is, especially, you know, when somebody comes into this space and they're already close to their fat threshold, say they're 100 pounds overweight and a lot of their fat cells are stuffed, you don't want a lot of fat in the diet. Because guess what happens? The fat cells are already saying, I don't want any more. And so too much fat coming in the diet, you'll actually see, you can do their blood tests. They'll see their triglycerides go through the roof because it's hanging out in the blood because the body is struggling to put it somewhere. And so you really want to restrict fat more in those people because they got to empty out their fat cells. Once their fat cells empty out, they say, okay, I won't reject insulin anymore. I'm happy now, you know, and you can be more metabolically healthy in that way. So That's an important piece, I think, to understand from the metabolic approach when it comes to fat.
I think and I understand.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, of course, you know, the precursor to understand to all that is the first thing you have to do is bring down your insulin level so that you can start releasing the fatty acids from the fat cells. Because when your insulin level is high, you can't release that.
Yes, but I would say it's the fasting insulin that you need to decrease.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I diverge a little bit too is, let's look at two charts. One where your fasting insulin is 2, and you got, you know, some spikes when you eat. So whenever you eat food, you're going to have a spike of insulin because the body does not like a lot of fuel in the blood. Too much glucose in the blood can kill you. Too much alcohol kill you. So the body's always tightly controlling the fuel in the blood. When you eat, you know, right now, us sitting here, you've got maybe 80 to 100 calories of fuel in your entire blood volume. That's all the ketones, all the free fatty acids, all the glucose. That's it. Alcohol, if you consume some. But, you know, that's all the fuel in the blood. When you eat a meal, 500, 800 calories, your body's got to work hard to keep the fuel down in the blood, right? So you're going to have a spike of insulin to take care of that. But if you look at, again, that if somebody with fasting insulin of 2 and they got these spikes from eating. Now look at somebody with fasting insulin of 20 and then spikes of eating too, right? Even if that person brought their spikes from eating down to nothing, but they're still at a fasting insulin of 20, it's going to be worlds more insulin than the person who's got a fasting insulin of 2 and huge spikes, right? Because you integrate under the curve, you got way more insulin. And somebody eating a low-carb diet like this, about 85% of the insulin your body produces and uses is fasted insulin. And then you have, you know, another 15% to deal with when you eat, right? So it's a fasting insulin that needs to come down. And how does that come down? When you shrink the fat cells. Because when they're overstuffed and inflamed, they're rejecting insulin, and insulin is driving. I mean, you can see this, there's studies on this as well. You'll see fasting insulin, as you get close to the personal fat threshold, it fasting insulin just increases and increases. And that's why somebody could be, again, type 2 diabetic, 105 pounds, with very high fasted insulin, or somebody could be 150 pounds overweight eating keto and still have insulin of 20. And I've seen it many times because they haven't lost the weight yet. And so that once you shrink the fat cells, you know, I like to think of insulin, yes, it's a storage hormone, but I like to think of it almost more as an, like a net holding back the floodgates of energy into the bloodstream. And so it's like this net over your fat cells saying, whoa, hold back the floodgates here. You know, we don't need all this fuel in the blood. Well, if you've got stuffed fat cells and a lot of them, you need a lot of insulin to hold back all those floodgates, right? And what happens with a type 1 diabetic? Everything's flooding the bloodstream. They're peeing out glucose and everything because all this energy is just flooding into the bloodstream and the body's just dumping it, right? And that's why they lose weight. So that's how I differ in that I think insulin is like this thermostat controlling the energy in the bloodstream and holding back the floodgates of all this energy. And if you have too much energy to hold back, fasting insulin's high. You start shrinking those fat cells, fasting insulin will come down.
So the insulin reacts to the fat that's already stored in the fat cells?
That's what fasting insulin is, right? So fasting insulin is...
That's completely backwards from what I understood.
When you haven't eaten anything, so there's no calories coming in.
Right.
You're in a fasted state. Your insulin will be at a certain level. And I encourage everyone to get that tested because it's a very good indicator of, you know, where your metabolic situation is. If you're in the, you know, 2, 3, 4 range, that's a great range. If you're up around 15, 20, you're at your personal fat threshold, you're in trouble. You need to lose some body fat. Because again, that fasted state, your body sitting on the couch, no energy coming in, all that insulin is sitting there to hold back the floodgates to keep all that fuel from dumping into the blood because it's not needed and you got to, you know, hold it back.
That makes sense.
That's the other role of insulin other than storing the stuff coming in. It's also holding the energy back.
That makes sense. Okay. I get it. I love being enlightened. That helps a lot.
Yeah. Phil, I think that
comments. Yeah.
Yeah. That is a little bit of a unique way of looking at it that perhaps a nuance that gets lost. You know, we think that the raised insulin level is because of the sort of constant oversupply of energy coming from our food primarily that then blocks the fat from being released as opposed to kind of that the body doesn't want to release the energy from those fat stores because there's already enough energy in the system.
Yeah. And, you know, again, if you look at a fasted state, so there's no energy coming in, right? So you're not elevating insulin. It's just what it does if you don't eat anything. If somebody's got a fasting insulin of 15 or 20, when they're not eating any food, that's what the body's doing is it's holding back the fuel, right? And that's the one you want to really work on because again, that's 85% of your insulin during the day is your fasted insulin state. And I'm not discounting the spikes. Like, believe me, I'm all in on keto and low carb and this approach. And you know, the thing about the spikes is they drive hunger and that's a bad cycle. We all know that cycle, right? You eat a bunch of carbs and that has a huge spike in insulin. Well, what's that do to your blood sugar? It makes it dive after it goes way up from the carbs you ate. Then the huge spike of insulin makes it dive. And guess what happens when your blood sugar is diving and it goes too low? You get hungry. That's why 2 hours after you eat, a flurry of 1,000 calories, you're hungry again because your blood sugar is crashing. And that's the hormonal side of keto, that the hunger hormones, the added hunger from the cycle of carbs that we get. So I'm definitely, you know, against large insulin spikes, you know, from meals too.
Okay. Would you mind, I realize we're at an hour here, but this is something I've heard about for a long time, and you brought it up, so it wasn't me. Can you go a little deeper into this, the chemistry of what's happening with the situation you just described? You eat a carb high meal. Just unpack that for me.
Yeah. So
body chemistry, metabolism. I want to understand that.
Yep. So eat a very high carb meal. And again, back to the, you know, blood in it right now, you're sitting here. If you got a blood sugar, blood glucose of 84 milligrams per deciliter, which would be perfect. That's about 4 grams of glucose in your entire blood volume. Okay. So that's 16 calories of glucose, sugar. When you eat a flurry and it's like 30 teaspoons of sugar, right? Your body's in panic mode, right? It only wants, you know, 4 grams of glucose in that blood, and you've got 40 grams coming in with that Mountain Dew, and that's going to be absorbed really fast, and your blood sugar is going to spike like crazy. So insulin's now in protective mode and saying, drive this out of the bloodstream before it kills us. And so insulin spikes really hard to deal with it, to drive that glucose down. And when it does it, because it's such a rapid, you know, spike, the rapid spike in insulin is going to drive it down fast, which it needs to prevent you from dying. But that driving it down fast almost always inevitably drives it a little too low as well. You know, kind of a rebound before it levels out. Guess what happens when that happens?
So at that point, we go from this perfect 86 or 84, whatever it was you said, to something significantly less.
Well, yeah. So let's say 84, you eat this huge high carb meal and you shoot to 250 and your body's in panic mode. It drives it down. Now it dips maybe below. But even the rapidly falling blood glucose can also drive some hunger. And especially when it gets too low and you start diving and you know, you've got this diving blood glucose and then it goes down to 60 or something before it levels out, boom, hunger. And now you're hungry and you're eating another meal. And guess what happens?
Oh, in fact, so yeah. The insufficient amount of energy in the bloodstream, which is the result of the insulin dump to deal with the carb dump.
Yeah.
That is what hunger is. Hey,
that's part of it.
I don't have enough fuel on board.
It's part of it.
It's not actually that you don't have enough, it's that it's going down. And so your body is anticipating that you won't have enough.
Yeah.
And so that's where we get into trouble, as opposed to someone who's eating low carb ketogenic type diet, that, you know, there's that more constant energy level from the ketones, primarily from the fatty acids, and you're not having this up and down that goes with the carbohydrates.
Yeah, think of it from an ancestral standpoint again. You know, you didn't have these Mountain Dew of processed refined sugar that just dumps into your bloodstream so rapidly, the body doesn't know what to do with it. You had more mild, you know, opportunistic, you ate some berries that you found. Well, guess what? There's not a lot of sugar in those to begin with, especially the ancestral ones, which were very tart. Nothing like today's, you know, we found some wild strawberries at my father-in-law's cabin. We spent an hour or two picking all we could find, and it barely filled the palm of my hand, you know, probably the size of one strawberry at the store, you know? So, you know, you're getting a little bit, so you get a little bit of an increase, you know, from that sugar, that glucose, from the sugar from the berries, and then it just, you know, gradually comes back down and it levels out. It don't get the dip, because that's more what your body's used to for a spike of glucose. If you dump 40 grams of refined sugar in a Mountain Dew into your body and you drink it in, you know, 20 minutes, it's panic mode. And when it's diving and going too low, then that's hunger. And that's why you get that cycle every every 2 hours you're hungry, even though you're eating tons of calories of, you know, sugar and whatever else is in the blizzard or whatever you're eating.
Well, the thought occurs to me as you're describing this entire process is, given how I know most Americans eat, it is astonishing how resilient our biology is, given the amount of abuse that we heap upon it and how long it takes for the poor behavior to actually begin manifesting in people.
Well, absolutely. And then you add in things like the food additives and chemicals that we've invented tens of thousands of in the last, you know, 30, 40 years. Our body doesn't know what to do with any of that stuff. It's crazy.
And the unfortunate pattern that we're seeing, though, is that, you know, we're at a point now where people's biologies are breaking earlier and earlier. And we see, you know, the epidemic of teenage type 2 diabetes, for instance. So we have really gotten to the point now that we have overwhelmed, as amazing a machine as our bodies are, and as much sort of, you know, reserve capacity has been built into them. We have now, you know, so toxified our environment with all the various things, the food and everything else that comes with it, that we're really starting to break the machinery. And that's why we see, you know, alarming statistics like, you know, for the first time in modern recorded history, that lifespans are actually starting to decrease.
Exactly. So, I mean, that's why we put such influence on, we wrote our Sugar-Free Kids book. I think it's important to start early. You know, our kids have eaten this way for over 12 years now, and they're thriving. And, you know, you look at kids and so many people will say, oh, is this safe for kids? I don't know. Is meat and low-carb vegetables safe for a kid? Like, compared to what they eat in the store today, the rainbow of crap, like, how is that safe for a kid? But, you know, steak and some broccoli is not. Like,
that's so ironic, isn't it?
But it's true. We get it.
My kids eat donuts and Doritos.
That's safe.
And
that's safe.
They're perfectly fine.
We get that all the time. And yet, so we think it's so important to start early. And, you know, so many people are like, just let them be kids. They don't magically turn 18 and say, oh, now I know how to eat healthy. Like, you got to educate them all the way through. We spend so much time and money on sports and activities and school for our kids, but the one thing that'll affect their health and longevity the most, their diet and nutrition, we don't do anything. And I think it has to be part of our education with our kids to help them understand what their food is and what they're putting in their mouth.
That sounds like we should have a whole show on that, Phil.
I think so. I think we have the follow-up show already laid out.
We should do that. Let's get all four of them on that. Well, at least have Craig and Maria back to, and we'll talk about eating healthy, for setting it up so your kids can have a good life because they've got a good foundation of solid nutrition.
Definitely.
Cool. All right. Well, we're gonna call it. We've been going at it for more than an hour. I've been totally loving the nerdy stuff, because I love to know how things really work. And I actually learned some things today that I've wondered about for a long time, like triglycerides. I didn't know that that's what a triglyceride was. I should have paid attention in chemistry class in 10th grade. I realized that. But there was this hottie who sat next to me all year long. It's not my fault. So.
That happens.
All right. Well, Craig, thanks for being with us. How do folks best connect with you?
I created a great landing page for us. It's ketomaria.com, and you can get to our blog where we sell our ebooks. And at the bottom, there's links to all of our social media. So just go to ketomaria.com and you can get to everything.
Ketomaria.com. Yep. I love it. Say four Our Fathers and 10 Keto Marias. Okay. Phil, thanks for putting this thing together.
Very good. Great talking with you, Craig, and keep up the great work. Keep putting out the great books. We didn't get to talk enough about it, but highly recommend the Sugar-Free Kids book. that you and Maria have. So we look forward to talking again.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate you having me on.
As always, subscribe. There's a button there somewhere on your podcast application. We drop a new episode every Tuesday at night, and we'll talk to you next time.
Chances are you wouldn't be listening to this podcast if you didn't need to change your life and get healthier. So take action right now. Book a call with Dr. Avedia's team. One small step in the right direction is all it takes to get started. Contact us at ifixhearts.com/talk. That's ifixhearts.com/talk.